Culture Presentation.
It's really lovely to get to talk to you, especially during a day and a couple, even last week. It's been kind of difficult, I think, for a lot of people with, you know, what's going on in the U.S. right now, and also the passing of David Lynch and what he meant to a lot of people. And so I wanted just to start in terms of having a conversation, and I'm probably projecting here because I know you are a lover of movies as well. I was listening to your interview for someone else's movie when you talked about Ali Theory, It's the Soul. There's a couple shots of satellite dishes that very much reminded me of David Lynch's own obsession with telephone lines and power lines. Was there any aspect of a filmmaker whose work you look at when you're watching, you know, your own work back to you that maybe you didn't notice before was an influence, or even someone that has inspired your own creative process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was just talking with another interviewer, and we were talking about David Lynch, and in the context of that, I was just saying, you know, with his passing, is kind of like he represents a time of innovation and philosophical artistic curiosity, where people could examine those things, have an audience, and it was kind of like exploration was rewarded, and I don't see that kind of exploration is as commonly seen as we did in previous generations. So it's almost like, wow, where is cinema going? But it's interesting too, because I just finished doing a meditation. David Lynch's children decided today at 3 p.m. to have a mass meditation for peace and well-being. Of course, David Lynch is like a high guy in the circles, like he's transcendental meditation for most of his life. So I have no doubt that he's floating, dipsy doodling in the universe, likely in nirvana, because he seems to have a real great hold on understanding of existence. And so I just came out, like I was doing a meditation at 3 p.m. because I wanted to be dialed in there. It was funny because I was like in a flurry of doing all this stuff, and I was like, oh shit, the mass meditation. Boom. And in my head, I was like, okay, think of world peace, especially with Trump being inaugurated, the wars, Palestine, everything is just like, the world is so, it's probably always been mad, but the seams in over COVID and all this time have just been torn apart, and we're seeing it on our screens and feeling it in life. So in my meditation, I was like, peace, 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 please, peace, please. And then after a while, I was like, okay, simmer down, Sukyin. Stop thinking about the peace. Just be the peace you seek. And without any words, I just felt sublime, a sublime feeling that lasted maybe a minute or two.
And that's sometimes all you can get. I mean, like, that's the thing where you have to realize there are certain things that are out of your control in life, but there are other things that you can do, you know, be the person you want to be and bring that into the world. And the thing that I love about your work and about this movie, there's a curiosity and an empathy and an understanding of the characters and allowing them to be who they are. And I was really curious about this because you've talked before about how much of your work is autobiographical in some way or another. But I was curious to know, how much of yourself did you want to be reflected in Sonny Lee? And what conversations did you have with Emily Lay about shaping that performance?
Yeah. I have always looked to my life experience, because life is much more extraordinary than anything one could confabulate. The details of our lives are incredible. Every single person's life are much more interesting than anything you could write in a script. So even when I write fiction, it comes from a seed, even if it's a paranormal ghost story, it comes from a seed of something that I actually experienced. And then I can sort of hang on to that feeling and then write from there. Because these events happened so far in the past, I felt that I was able to, I didn't call her Sukyin, I called her Sunny, because she was kind of borrowed aspects of what truly happened to me, but also in the world of sort of autofiction, used imagination as well. And I knew that Emily would be bringing herself to the role too. So in terms of like the actual intensity, I think enough time had passed since my young adulthood that I could bring some kind of, I guess wisdom, or at least being able to clearly see the events without getting, you know, pulled into the upset of it, you know, still be able to kind of see it with some kind of logic, or what's it called when you see something from?
Well, from retrospective, there's a feeling of like it's more pragmatic, and you're more kind of almost, you know, looking at it from the you know, you've been removed from that time a little bit, so you can see things almost in a kind of more, I guess. We'll find it out.
Sounds like oatmeal. No, yeah. So, you know, and with Emily, I was really happy, you know, that she's a person who her emotions are very close to the surface. She's a much more cool customer than me. I tend to be sometimes manic, erratic, emotional. And she's really a calm customer, but she's an actor. So, and she also has great emotional reserves close to the surface, which I really love. And, you know, I would, because I could, you know, she's a total different gen. And even vernacular and much music, I realized that I had given her an entire paragraph that were proper nouns. She didn't know what the Halifax pop explosion was, or, you know, a lot of different things. So, and, or like what the thrush hermit, what, so I'd have to like talk her through all the minutiae. And because I understood, it's a very great also and convenient to have a movie that, you know, the details, you know, you understand the psychology. So then if an actor or any person on the creative team has a question, I could bring up a photo, an actual document photo, or show, you know, Emily and Dan a situation, or even specifically tell them, you know, if her take needed to be revised, I would be able to speak with her about, you know, where it was slightly different. And she would be able to like, okay. She was hungry to know those nuances and to enact those. So she was a real great collaborator, just like an athlete who wants to never down for the count, and just like, okay, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do, tell me more. Tell me. Okay. Got it. You got it. Yeah, it's great. We can move on, you know? And then Dan is a guy who really understood and shares a lot of commonalities with Chester. The two of them have very similar, very shared worldviews on the important subjects. And he had already been a big fan of the source material, big fan of Chester. And he understood the character, understood him, and he didn't need a whole lot. You know, with Dan, I just like, and then if I gave him a direction, it would have to be something that he had never considered, that he went, oh my God, that's a great idea. You know, so different actors require different things. I think I'm thinking about like your opening question about the satellite dishes and the electricity.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I was shooting down, I not only shot at my home where the real life events took place, which was not only affordable, but it was also because it's almost like it's shooting in a space with real feelings. So that sort of exudes in the mise-en-scène. So I did that with all the locations and borrowed my friends' places, time era, you know, era correct 90s spaces, brothels, and called up my former employee, Moses Neimer, who hired me at Much Music. I said, I need to have a TV station. Can I use yours? And he let me use his studio on a weekend. But his studio didn't really look like Much Music. Like it's down in the Liberty District area, and it's more like a big sort of concrete building. It didn't look like the Queen John's. I had to reconstruct that, but I couldn't from the outside. But it was really important to be able to have, you know, an exterior shot. And I was looking around like, yes, that's what they shared, was the satellite dishes on the top. And I could reprise those satellite dishes. And one of them is a kind of like coincidence. I was playing around with the idea of not only gentrification. So when you see the city, like I found era-specific 90s, 2000s feeling places that still exist. But then a lot of like, oh, juxtaposed with construction and like towers and, you know, as you say, the electricity line. So you get a feeling of that disappearing city without banging, you know, banging over the head. Also with the increase in corporatization of much music. When I went there, it was like easy breezy. I could like ask for a slow zoom into my hairy armpit. And the team was like, yeah, that's great. Let's do it. It was like very free,
non-experimental.
It was so fun. And there were hours to fill that, you know, like I would show people how to get rid of trapped gas by putting their bum in the air because hot air rises. And people to this day go, that time you showed me how to relieve trapped gas. Like, it's live television, unscripted, was really bonkers and revolutionary. But then there came a point where I was like asked to do, and this was like bosses change, interests change. Then it was like more corporate sponsors and then bean counters looking at ratings. And then it was like, so can you cover the Colgate DJ challenge? And that kind of like led to my disinterest in being there. And this similar thing is happening in the world of underground, you know, comics. So underground comics percolating to zine culture, DIY culture, lo-fi music was all coalescing at that time in the 90s. And then I kind of show how, you know, the evolution of corporatization of much music, you know, and then all the evolution of independent stuff being superseded by superhero comics, you know, that kind of thing. So I didn't want to make something that felt just nostalgic. I wanted to use the nostalgic for a purpose for today. And I think the larger and more interesting conversation is looking at relationships and pondering intimacy, questioning our the way in which our beliefs around intimate relationships are, our biases, our assumptions, challenging those and maybe seeing that there might be another way to engage with care with another human being that doesn't equal possessive monogamy. And also the notion of examining sex work as Chester did in his graphic novel as work. And to my mind, really focusing on the fact that it is labor and labor that is expected within a very unfair practice because consensual sex workers are granted very few rights in our society. So, you know, there are heavy politics, but under the glean of something that's sweethearted and kind of relatable. So I kind of like to do that kind of story.
Absolutely. And it does feel political, but not, you know, you're obscuring some of that where it's very much, you know, I've heard you talk about, you know, there's an academic aspect and a historical aspect to Chester Brown's writing as well. And so I was curious in terms of how do you approach both that and, you know, the autobiographical autofiction aspect of it? And did you and co-writer Joanna Sarazin feel like you had the creative freedom to kind of shape the narrative in a way that worked for both the autofiction and being true to the graphic novel?
Well, I was such a fan of the graphic novel and I wanted to make a movie that Chester loved. And it was very challenging. It took years and years of very many. I've got hundreds of drafts and many of the drafts did not include my character. Many of them were verbatim his comic and they didn't work. They were too episodic. They wouldn't work. I couldn't get funding for them. And they were myopically focused on his perspective because he didn't show anything of the sex workers' lives because he was protecting their privacy, as well as characters like myself. He was very light on the touch because he didn't want to reveal too much. I wanted to bring the sex workers to life. And so, you know, it was a challenging process because comics are not movies. And I did want to kind of tell a movie that is three-act structure that is about flawed characters that go through transformations and how to couch those within, like, those political ideas in his work are so important. But I was very lucky to have a mentor, Laurent Canté, and he is a French filmmaker. He passed away a couple years ago, but I was very lucky to have his friendship. And he is a very political filmmaker. He did The Class and many amazing films. And he said that, of course, his work is political, but what he does is he understands his structure is political, but his job as a filmmaker is to obscure the scaffolding. So we're not getting the political message first, but we're surrendering and falling into the drama, the action, the story of what is happening to the people. But because it's structured, the politics is underneath there. You feel that. But it's not like it's poking out over top. It's really about a story about people. So I really took that idea, which I love, and applied it with Chester's show. To me, it was about distilling the finer points, the most important points of his argument. He goes into all kinds of stuff. He talks about, like, you know, tribal groups in China from two centuries ago where families are, you know, matrilineal. And, like, I'm not going to get into those things, but I would take, you know, the most important six aspects of his argument and then see how I could manifest that in action and character. So for example, the questioning of possessive romantic monogamy, which is a crux of his argument, how am I going to do that? And it wasn't until I realized that by expanding the canvas and addressing that with my character, Sonny, because that's what I was doing, is possessive romantic monogamy, whereas Chester was paying for sex. So I could kind of explore some of those ideas with my character. And so the next thing would be not only just exploring that notion, but bringing my character to life, which meant bringing more of my experience and, like, my experiences into the script. So yeah, it was a delicate dance to, like, what's too much, what's too over the top. You know, there's, you know, I talk about, there's one particular scene where Chester goes to the brothel to see Anne, and he finds the place is completely wrecked, and Anne's disappeared, and her friend Amanda is, like, packing up her stuff, like an office worker has to leave her job, into a box. And Chester's like, what happened? And she says, you know, we were raided by the cops. And he's like, oh shit, were you arrested? And she says, no, they wrecked everything. They wrecked the apartment and they took our money, you know? And so that was an actual account that I had heard from a sex worker, where it's so bad that you can, you know, it's the people that would in society protect you. They're the ones who are robbing you and wrecking your shit. And so, you know, but in the scene, I wanted it to feel like, you know, it could have been very didactic. The first time that I wrote it, it was like she had sunglasses on, and then she lowers her sunglasses as there's a black eye. And then at the time, you know, it just didn't seem right. Like, I could still have all those things, not show the violence. You know, I didn't ever show the violence on camera, but the aftermath of the violence, and just to see her and see the place wrecked and not know what happened to Anne. That scene is juxtaposed with Sonny in one of her relationships gone south, where violence erupts in a domestic argument between her and her boyfriend, who has an anger management problem, and he is at the same time wrecked her apartment. These are kind of like, this kind of domestic violence occurs within the workplace and in personal lives that I wanted to sort of juxtapose. And so when you watch it, it sounds heavy when I'm telling you, but it's like you watch and it's like, oh, okay. You know, and so what are the, you know, so it's supposed to be pointed, but then it also is married to the story. So you're not just like, oh, you know, tonally thrown out of something. It helps that the violence is off screen, but you do see the repercussion. And that Absolutely. Was important to me. So, like, but you know, it passes, and because it's like within this thing, and they're very lovable, all the characters. And, you know, I try to humanize and humanize everyone. I don't glamorize nor denigrate sex work, but I ask audiences to question the unfair practice of not granting consensual sex workers, you know, rights. You know, I'm glad to see this is changing. I understand that there's, I think it was Belgium that just recently granted legitimate rights, like, you know, leave of absence and, like, dental and stuff like that. So it's like, oh, that's very progressive.
Yeah. But so, it does feel like we are, you know, we're progressing in some ways and then regressing in other ways. You know, for every, you know, movement forward, we're going backwards. And, you know, to your point that the scene you just mentioned, like, I still think about it, having watched it twice, where, like, did Anne get that money that Chester, you know, gave to Amanda? And I think about, like, little things like that, or, you know, like, how was Mo after you know, that domestic abuse as well. And, you know, like what goes on, you know, moving forward. And those little sort of details, interiors feel very lived in and real, to your point. And there's another person I wanted to ask you about, because you have talked about, you know, working with her as a consultant, but also, you know, having information and in terms of education about sex work and, you know, decriminalizing it, is Valerie Scott.
Yes.
Her contribution.
Oh my God, I love her. Yeah, Valerie Scott's super cool. She and Chester were friends, so he introduced me to her, and she's been such a great person to lean upon for hearing about sex work, hearing about her thoughts. So Valerie Scott was one of three consensual sex workers who successfully went to the Supreme Court of Canada and won, striking down anti-prostitution laws, both provincially and federally. So it was a real victory. But then the government at the time, the conservative government at the time, went, yeah, you win, but we're going to enact a new law, and we are now criminalizing the Johns. So that's where we stand today. So it was a hollow victory. It's like having a DVD store full of shows, full of DVDs, but nobody can watch those DVDs. So like, it's like, it's pretty backwards. There's a new case in the prairies where just the car drivers, the people that drive the sex workers to work safely, they were charged with profiting off of sex work. And so they're bringing to the Supreme Court of Canada their case. They're like, we're driving them. And sex workers are asking to have their points of view included in the case. So, you know, things are changing a bit. But, you know, Valerie, she has been on the front line. She has been, she's had a wealth of experience and, you know, fought for sex worker rights. And she's really, she's such a warrior and such an inspiration. And you know, she had shared details of her life and relationships with clients that really helped to inform much of the perspective that I had with some of the sex workers in the movie. And you know, I was, you know, it's challenging because this is a really just scratching the surface. I have done a sex work adjacent work. In terms of like short bus, you know, I did actual sex for a movie and got paid for it. But it's not like I have never been, you know, quote unquote, a sex worker. So I look forward to more sex workers telling their stories because there's so many nuanced and interesting perspectives. I am aware of great films from Hong Kong that are about sex work. And also one that run, The Lady Who Climbs the Stairs is from the 60s, a Japanese film about a brothel owner that is very, very good. And there's some American movies from the 80s, but by and large, much of what we have in cinema are two-dimensional. Clients are demonized. They're horrible, awful people. I try to, you know, depict them as not vile human beings. And I try to depict sex workers as not pitiful victims, but, you know, people, human beings. And so with Valerie, I sent her the film and I was like, I know, I here you go. What do you think? And she loved it. And I was just like, Chester loves it as well. And I was so happy because I know that it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And there are many different sex work experiences. And because there is so little representation, it can't please everyone and it can't reflect everyone's experience. And so I tried to tell the best story that I could from my perspective. And I was really heartened to hear Valerie say, you know, that a kind of sweethearted human story can be more powerful and slyly political and change things more than a film that bashes people over the head with politics. And so I was like, oh, thank you. And I really love her very much.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I think like it's really important because I know that, you know, one of the actors in the film, Andrea Wareham, has mentioned in Toronto Life that every, you know, sex worker story is different. And it's not just, you know, one kind of baseline in terms of telling these stories. And so when you're watching this film, you know, everybody's perspective is different. I was curious because you mentioned Short Bus and it just got a 4K release recently. And I wanted to know if it was true that you wrote to ACTRA about using people that are non-professional actors for the film, and did that inform that letter that you wrote based on your work on Short Bus in terms of using non-actors for that film, because SAG was also a little bit iffy on using actors.
Totally different situations.
Yeah.
But Short Bus being an explicitly sexual film, what happened then was SAG has a rule. It's the Screen Actors Guild. It's the union. If you have one or two SAG performers, then everything has to be SAG. So that was problematic because we were depicting the New York underground of that time. And in fact, performance artists like Justin Vivian Bond was playing herself. And she is a non-actor. Very many people were playing themselves. So they would want us to hire a union person, likely with no experience in the New York underground, to play that person. So, you know, and to get union actors to perform unsimulated sex, very difficult. It was a situation where there was a consternation about that, and because it was explicitly sexual and also super gay. And my managers at CBC, they had let me do the movie. We were developing it for 3 years, and then we finally got the script together and the funding, and they were like, they dialed into the website in progress and saw two men having sex. And they were like, whoa, 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 whoa. We can't let you do that. So it was basically the CBC gave me an ultimatum. Either you do the movie or we won't. If you do the movie, we won't extend your contract. It was sort of a passive-aggressive play like that. So we really had to lobby a lot of heavyweights in the art community. The biggest, Coppola, Athamagoyan, Yoko Ono, Moby, like all a force of artists just came to our defense. And so we were able to continue, basically CBC, they just assumed that people would be very upset knowing that one of their hosts was involved in a super queer explicit sex movie. But the public was more concerned that they were trying to, control what happened in my personal life. So then there was more of a kickback about that. And so finally they allowed me to do it, provided that I didn't talk about what had happened behind the scenes. And with the SAG stuff, I can't actually reveal what they did, but there was a workaround where SAG was just more like, oh, hey, do whatever you want. Just don't have our logo there. And so that was the thing that was the stroke of brilliance from John's team. I can't say what it is because I don't know if that's public.
Right.
But they said something to SAG, which made SAG go, we don't want anything to do with this. And then oddly enough, the movie premiered at Cannes to a 20-minute standing ovation. And every single person at CBC, all the middle managers up to the top who were like, oh, no, oh, no, were like, oh, my God, I love that movie so much. So it really revealed to me about the inner workings of fear, the tower of fear in an institution. And it was sort of a necessary conversation. It was a painful conversation. It was a painful time. I felt like I was being persecuted on all fronts. It was really hard. But then that whole argument turned into a workers' rights conversation that wasn't just about whether or not Sukin can be in the movie, but was about how everyone on the workforce, what they can do and what your boss can't tell you what to do. And so that was really important. And then so with this one, this movie, of course, having had that experience and knowing that I couldn't make a movie, like paying for it without, having some nakedness and sexuality and full frontal, that's always very tender for actors. I was very lucky. Dan Byrne was like, no problem, Sukin. In my solo shots, I'm free as a bird, no problem. And it was like, these days we see a lot of sexuality, but oftentimes people are wearing fake ones. They want the fake perfect penis. So on Euphoria, you see a large schlong, but they're perfect fake ones.
And or insert shots like in Lars von Trier's Antichrist and things like that. It's always embellished.
Kind of removed.
Yeah.
And whereas this wasn't supposed to be glamorous. This is like, I like sex is like feels real to me. Or like the nakedness is really a metaphor for being exposed and vulnerable as a person. And it's like the nudity that we have in the shower when we wake up and scratch our balls and like walk across the room, you know, with like morning breath, you know, like it's not glamorous or super sexy. It's just real.
Yes.
And so I just kind of wanted to be able to, the male full frontal was more perturbing or shocking to people. It was like, he's just walking across the room without any clothes on. What's the big deal?
We're so desensitized to violence, or we're more accepting of violence in film than just the natural human body, that I think it's strange that we're still sort of almost, you know, disturbed, or at least we remember, you know, that more than like, say, someone being shot or stabbed or, you know, in peril. And it says something, especially about North American audiences with like that prudish nature. And what you were talking about, you know, with like that was Short Bus was what, 2006. And it feels like there's some ways where we still haven't, you know, progressed in that way.
Yeah. And it shares some of the vulnerability, you know, and shame around our bodies, and cover it up. And when we're not able to just be with ourselves as we're born and as we lay in bed and shower, you know, it's when it's so stigmatized and associated with something embarrassing and shameful, it kind of gets repressed and comes out in really kind of intense and sometimes very unhealthy ways. I remember reading an article in the Yatney Reader long ago, and it was a woman who had come from a country in Africa, and she visited Los Angeles, and she was really taken aback by all the big billboards of super sexed up, like super lubed up people and like very exoticized sexual content, or like power sex or whatever. And she's like, this to me is indicative of a culture that is starved for spiritual connection. The first thing you do is like, we're going to just gloss it up and big it up, you know? And I thought that at that point, I was a teenager. That made a lot of sense to me. So we're still at that point. So, I mean, it is, there's a lot of weird stuff happening in our world. There's a lot of wonderful stuff. There's a lot of possibility of difficulty and alienation more, and more Puritanism and more pointing each other out and more war and et cetera. But then there's also the possibility to open it up with care and care. And also the idea of like challenging our assumptions, or knowing that the rigid ways in which we've lived our lives, maybe there's a bit more wiggle room where we can actually allow ourselves to breathe a bit more, not expect too much, or not grip so tight upon somebody else, or keep ourselves down like this and do it in a way that is truthful, honest, authentic, and caring. Just like I feel like my relationship with Chester has been all of our lives.
And it's the movie itself, I think, reflects all those things. It is so humane. And as you mentioned, like it's vulnerable and intimate in a way that feels like we don't get this kind of movie very often. And it to be shot in 20 days and, you know, the people that you rallied and you doing, you know, multiple jobs, not just, you know, composing the score and directing and co-writing, but second unit and providing art. Like it says so much.
Thank you for observing those things, because I really appreciate it. Those things sometimes go observed. So thank you so much. I'm thinking about what you said, because I didn't answer the other side of the question about ACTRA this time.
Yes.
So I knew that I wanted to cast for the sex worker roles people with a nuanced and empathetic understanding of a consensual sex worker. Many of these people are my friends. They're non-actors. They're artists in their own right. They're musicians. They're comedians. They're visual artists. They're activists. And all of them are sex positive, have sex positive expression in their work. So I knew that I wanted to work with them. It's really key in this day and age who gets to tell the story. And also, not only just on a ideological sense, but they bring so much value. Many times they would go, okay, this costume doesn't look right. Or this, we'll tweak it like this. Or they'd suggest something. And it would be like, ah, that brings us closer to authenticity. And so, you know, I anticipated a fight with ACTRA. You know, they're still mad at me because I haven't joined ACTRA. I always paid the permits because I just do weird art movies. And if I wouldn't be able to do them. I don't get cast in Hallmark movies and stuff like that. So
no, but you're a great actor. I mean, I just saw you in Darkest Miriam. You know, like it's one of those things where like anytime you pop up, it's always wonderful to see you in roles. And you are like a talented actor. So, you know, but obviously, you know, it's your choice as well. So
yeah, I mean, if I joined, I wouldn't be able to do most of the weird little art movies that I do. So it's been a specific choice. And they're like, they're like. You can join. And I'm like, I don't want to. And they're like, I said, it's kind of like being a musician and you're told that you have to join something that you'll only be able to write commercial jingles for the rest of your life and never your own songs.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, if you change your mind.
Was there ever any worry about... I'm curious, was there ever any worry about this movie becoming a studio film or something that would be a lot bigger or censored in some way?
There were some really mighty filmmakers that had approached Chester and he didn't give the rights to them because it could become a really bro down Hollywood laugh a chuckle minute, you know, like it could have been done that way.
Absolutely.
At the point where, what's his name? The guy, the actor who had the falling out with Seth Rogen, and because he was...
Oh, Adam McKay.
No,
it's Will Ferrell, sorry.
No.
James Franco?
Yes.
Yes.
He wanted to be Chester.
Oh.
Yeah. This is before the whole call out and stuff, and it was like, yeah. Franco's a big Chester fan. Like, all those guys, Ben Stiller, they're all big. The guys from, like, Mr. Show were like...
Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, Odenkirk came and visited visited Chester in his room downstairs and he was like shaking his head and going, Chester, do you really have to live like this? And just, and
he seems so happy. Like, I mean, just that one photo that's posted of you two together, you know, swarmed by all of his books. Like, it seems like he has found the life that he is just completely content and happy with.
He always has.
Yeah.
He always has. So, you know, I was anticipating it was going to be difficult for me with ACTRA. But then I wrote a long letter saying, you know, at this point, and you know, one of the actors was just like, this is a very meaningful, had given me a wonderful quote, like, this is meaningful. This to be able to enact this role and with care really helps my younger self, you know, work through some of the difficult events of my life. So, you know, I sent that to them and I sent it to them through the producers and I was anticipating an argument and kickback, but no, they were like, we agree. And I was like, thank God. They said, no problem at all, but you have to make sure every single other actor is part of the union.
Right.
And so there are a couple other actors that were not, that I had to say, I'm sorry, I can't hire you. Everyone else has to. I'm like, okay, that's fair.
Yeah, and you know, it's a great dynamic through all the characters and the performances, and you know, going back to even like, I feel like if this was made by the studio system, you know, the character that Laura Applebaum plays in the movie might be the love interest or the one that's kind of like put into like a subplot or something like that, but you never do that, and like those little things are appreciated as well. There is something I'm curious about because, you know, being from the Durham region, I'm from Whitby, and my best friend and fellow podcaster Matt is from Oshawa. There's a call out or call in from Kaylee. Was that based on anything in particular, or was that just because you never, it's so easy to, you know, look down on people from the Durham region specifically as like the bridge and tunnel crowd, but you didn't do that. It was just a funny kind of call letter moment in the movie that someone from Oshawa would call in.
For sure. I mean, that's directly correlated to my experience as a VJ at Much Music. You know, Moses let us shoot in his studio on the weekend, but when we went there, it was like, holy shit, it's set up for this variety show, Marilyn Lightstone's variety show, and there's all these jukeboxes up. This is totally the wrong look. And so the art team was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? I'm like, okay, okay, simple. I had to like go, okay, the semiotics of Much Music. All you need is an exposed brick wall, a ladder leaning up against the wall, two warring gels of different colors, and a carpeted wedge for me to sit on, and a large ass TV. And then they're like, ah, great. It's all there, like very small things. And suddenly you've got the Much Music environment. And then there was the review, request show. Most of my team were like Gen Z and millennials. They're like, they didn't watch Much Music. I'm like, this is the request show. People would send in requests through fax, mail, phone, and they draw their artwork. And then so Dylan Mitra, who was the art director, he was like, okay. And he just got his team to make all these like requests and stuff. And just even like how the titles come in, like Oshawa, Ontario, of course, we'd get lots of fans from there, you know, calling in, and in many, many towns. Much Music was a space where it was all kind of the kind of town hall for kids. And they'd just hang out there. They physically go there and like tune in. It was all like, kind of prior. Well, there was internet, but it was all like Netscape and very clunky. So, yeah, that was all. The great thing is when you make a movie that you've lived it, you can tell the art team and the actors exactly kind of like how it goes, because you know what it is.
Absolutely. Oh, I have to wrap with you, but I want to just ask you one last question, because I think this is important as well, because the movie is coming out on January 31st. And, you know, one thing I'm always curious about, because I am, you know, someone that loves collecting Blu-rays, is there a thought process in preserving, paying for it and your past films on physical media? Because it does feel like there is this new interest in Canadian cinema that a lot of up and coming cinephiles and film critics that don't have the access to even just the last two decades of film being readily available. And it would be nice to have that history.
Yes. I mean, okay, so a lot of stuff is on the cloud now. And like, we're coming out with a soundtrack album. Dylan and Gamble and I made the score. And my record company, Mint Records, is putting it out. And we're announcing it in a couple days. And we're making CDs. And CDs seem to be a thing of the past, but they're like, no, we sell more CDs these days. Because it's like, people want the object because they don't want it just to be on the cloud. And it's meaningful to have a shelf and like things you can look at in an object. And it also helps you, like, it's hard to make a living as an artist. So when you have objects, like, so we're going to have t-shirts. Chester's designed a t-shirt. We have the CD. And he's got the new film edition of the graphic novel. These are very precious works of art. And they kind of like, they also live, this is a multimedia expression that kind of lives on all of these things, and is, I think, so nice to have. I think that it was interesting to hear from the record company that, like, vinyl, ever since Taylor Swift and the big stars have kind of dominated the vinyl pressing plants, vinyl's still very, very big. But it's they're finding that CDs is a thing that people are now turning to, which is very interesting.
So it's cyclical, right? Like, it feels even like with fashion, like even looking at some of the fashion in this movie, like, it comes back in a way, you know, it never completely dies out.
No. And it's, I'm so glad. Like, I was like, oh man, CD, like, you know, I make micro movies with Dylan. We made a couple lockdown movies that were like super micro budget.
Was Rest and Relax one of them? Because it says that came out last year. So was that shot around the same time?
Well, the first one was Death and Sickness. Yeah. And then Rest and Relax came out. And we only screened it in person at micro movie cinemas. So one in Montreal and one here. And when we went to Eyesore Cinema, they're like, do you have any merch? And we're like, no. And they're like, you should have merch. And we're like, oh, fuck, okay. And so I had this old CD burner from like years ago. I'm like, Dylan, let's make some CDs of the music. And so we just made like, it was like the good old days, you know, like zine culture. We made a little like manufacturing thing where I do something and then he'd do the other stuff on the cover. And we made like hand-drawn covers. And then I was burning CDs. He was like, I haven't seen a CD player since I was 12. You know, so it's like, I can't believe I still have the CD player. So then we were able to like press 12 copies of these handmade CDs and then sell them. And it was like, oh, yay. For an artist, it's helpful because
it's the tangible thing too, right? Because like fans want to support the artist and it feels like, okay, you have something that you can keep and it's there for you when you want it. You want to seek either, whether it be for comfort or just revisit, you know, something that means something to you. And like, even now, like it does feel, you know, I was mentioning it before, like Adam Egoyan is working a lot recently with both Criterion and Canadian International Pictures to release some of his older movies. And, you know, like, I love to see that Canadian cinema and, you know, independent cinema is getting that due that it maybe hadn't in the last 20, 30 years. And I feel like, again, like your films, like, you know, even like seeing something like Short Butts, which, you know, John Cameron Mitchell is an executive producer on this, getting a 4K release is incredible. And what Oscilloscope did with that release is awesome. Yeah. So, you know, like it's always exciting to see, like, obviously, you know, the festivals are important as well. You know, TIFF in Canada's top 10. And I'm sure like that also like plays a big part in terms of the life of a film for paying for it. But there is something about like after the theatrical run and after, you know, even just like the initial streaming run has done, where it's like, okay, well, where can I find this movie? Because streaming isn't permanent. So
no, for sure. And I located an awesome duplicator place outside of Toronto. I'm Dylan and I made a day trip to go out there, and it was like, what? They had all those like cassette tapes. They do VHS. They do Blu-ray. They do every single form. And they were fans of mine from Much Music. They're like, anytime. Come on over and we'll make whatever you need. So I think it's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really had a wonderful conversation, but also, you know, the movie is just so lovely and like it gets even better on rewatch and little details and moments throughout the film that you just really appreciate even more. Like even just like the smallest thing of like water damage, you know, in one scene behind a on a wall, like just like little things you notice because it feels so lived in and, you know, authentic to the perspective.
There were a lot of Easter eggs there. So many. There was a period where I was realizing there was a bottle of lube that was finding itself in different positions and different scenes. I was like, there it is again. Yeah, there's so many wonderful things. Like I did a shot in Chester's actual apartment because it was such a quick shoot that I realized I needed to get to bring, you know, find other shots and so forth. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of really,
there's some beautiful shots in this movie too. Like there's that one shot of Dan Byrne as Chester in the basement. And I think it's early on where you see like that shaft of light from the basement window coming in. And it is so gorgeous. And I know you've talked about Leo Carax and 80s Taiwanese cinema and in terms of being influences as well. And you know, for a movie that I think a lot of people, when they think about like a graphic novel like this, it's often flat looking, but there's something so beautiful when like the moments present themselves.
Yeah, you know that, again, you know, Chester is a person like the score, he listens to a lot of classical music. So when we were devising the score, like Peter and the Wolf, we were wanting to have a kind of type of music associated with Chester's character. So that was classical music. With Sunny, it was more like diegetic music in her work environment, pop songs, more erratic. But specifically the look of Chester as well, he's a very calm and logical person. So that particular image that you're talking about is entirely a swipe from a classic painting, a Vermeer painting.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now that you're saying it, it's making perfect sense. It's clicking.
It just made sense because he's like that classical Vermeer scholar by himself in the basement. I'm going to try to bring it up for you and see if I have it.
I'd love to see that. Yeah. And again, like with, I know we've talked about Dan Byrne, but I really love that, you know, again, talking about actors, the complication of that character, because Dan Byrne has done such great work, but he often plays a bumbling bureaucrat, whether it be in the 20th century or even I Like Movies, or someone who's a complete misogynistic jerk, like in Ally
McBeal's Really?
I Used to Be Funny. But here he's so complex and, you know, very much still introverted, but it felt like you brought out something in him that I haven't seen before. So,
oh, that's so cool. I love that. I mean, Dan is monstrously talented, and you know, he injured himself. He twisted his ankle on a day that he was scheduled to do a tap dancing number. I had to scrap the tap dancing number, but I did. I was able to prop him up. And he did this thing where he just moved his upper body, and such a pro, he made it look like he was dancing.
Yeah. I mean, the whole cast is great. But yeah, it's always nice when, like, you see an actor in a different way, or a way that you've never seen them before. And so, like, for that, like, I was really charmed by that performance, even though he's great in everything he does. But it was really nice to see something like that brought out in an actor that you haven't seen before.
I'm sorry that I'm having a hard time finding
this. No, that's okay.
Do you have a second?
Yeah, I do. Or, I do. As long as Angie has a second, I feel really bad.
You can just snip it.
Yes, yes. But yeah, I honestly, it's nice to have this conversation, because like I've just been, you know, all weekend watching David Lynch movies, and you know, with the inauguration as well, it just felt like a bit of a downer.
Oh my God. And so, like, the inauguration coinciding with the ceasefire.
Yeah.
It's like, they're so, you know, I'm glad there's a ceasefire, but I also wonder, like, part of it just seems like a promo thing for the, you know, Biden and Trump. It's like so strange to see how everything's kind of entwined together, and it feels like all is not as it appears.
And how it's even just affecting art. Like, I feel like, you know, the conversation about No Other Land, the documentary, which is getting re-released at TIFF, which is great, has not gotten distribution in North America, and it's struggled to. Yeah, so.
The Union movie.
Yes.
The Amazon one?
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah, that's another one that has had difficulty finding.
People are really freaked out, and they're, you see this sort of like in the whole like anti-woke thing. It's like, what? I feel like there's something complicated there that's not being exposed there. I mean, I don't see a whole lot of people online like going, oh God, you know. I just think it's a prefabricated term anyway, made up by people who thought that they were going to lose business if they weren't woke. So I don't even know what they even mean by all that stuff, but I'm not seeing like activists going, oh God, we're getting, it seems like a fabric. It's very weird. And the role of the artist being able to speak freely without repercussion. I mean, artists have always had to be brave. The whole digital factor, that it's harder to make a living more than ever. It's complicated. And then it's not just about art, but it's all about our lives. Like, if we don't move with better choices, we're going to really go back downhill for everyone. So we're in a very interesting time. And like, my favorite movies come from countries where there's a lot of upheaval, political upheaval. They're very meaningful, you know. Romania, Iran, China, so many great films. And so I think we are entering a time of upheaval. I think it's as much upheaval as 1968, when the world was on fire, but completely different now. And this is always a good time to make art, always a good time. And artists are, that's their job, their responsibility to reflect the world. But then there are forces that are trying to squash that kind of expression. So I think they're confused about stuff, and people like yourself will want to seek it out. So, you know,
absolutely.
At the same time, you know, there's during the Depression, you know, it was dance movies and happy sing-along movies were really popular. So I think it's just a rich, very rich time to make art. So this is the Vermeer painting.
Oh, yes, yes. That looks amazing. And like thinking about now the image now that, that you created in, for the film is, that's a really lovely.
It's essentially Chester. Cause yeah. He did have that tiny wall, the window looking onto the sidewalk. And I was like, get a shaft of light. We're going to make him look like the Renaissance artist he is.
Yeah, because I even thought about it. There's the when he moves into his new place, there's a shot where he's kind of like alone and a little bit to the left. And then even the final shot of the film where Sonny and Chester are sitting on the bed together after, yeah. You know, mourning Mo. Like those shots are so beautifully composed and painterly that, you know, like they're not. You know, you're not trying to aesthetically suffocate the audience throughout and remind people that it's based on a graphic novel or it's based on art. But when it presents itself, the image stays in your mind.
Yeah. And I was with Edward Yang. I love him so much. And these are people that really allow scenes to breathe. Oftentimes people will go to a cutaway or go to a close up. And, to me, I mean, sometimes it's exciting, but then if what the actors are doing is interesting and you just keep on them, it becomes riveting. You can't turn away.
Yeah, you feel that flow. It's very natural. And I like that you said that because it does feel like, you know, people are afraid to let scenes not only breathe, but even with music, it's like more is the best, you know, or to cover it. And it's not just simply, you know, enjoying the stillness, enjoying the silence, enjoying the conversation. We have to create more dynamic.
Or you have to tell the audience how to feel. It's like, well, cue the bad guy music.
Yeah, exactly.
Cue the violins.
And you could have easily vilified one of the two leads for choices that, you know, they make, and you never do. And I think like in Lesser Hands, that probably would have been the situation. Like, you know, somebody's in the wrong here and it never feels like that at all, ever.
They make decisions that get you in trouble, just like in life.
Yeah.
But it's not. Yeah. I try to look at like the choices made and, you know, try to illuminate kind of why we do things, you know. So we do a lot of stuff, good and bad and boring and in the media, you know, all kinds of things that lead to many things.
Yeah, people are complicated and sometimes contradictions and messy. And this movie reflects that. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, you know, and like this and really appreciate it.